there is a historic high availability of lab space across the United States compared to demand. We've never seen this degree of disequilibrium before. And we're just now starting to come down off of the peak of that, where we're about 3x or 4x, depending on the market, with too much space. To be crass, we're a python swallowing a pig.
Hello and welcome to The REIT Report. I'm your host, Sarah Borks from Quito. In this episode of the podcast, I'm speaking with Travis McCready, Head of Life Sciences Americas Markets at JLL, about some of the major trends expected to shape the life science industry in the year ahead and what that means for the underlying real estate. Travis, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you so much. It's great to be back, Sarah.
So normally I would start by asking you about the broader state of the life science market in early 2024, but after I've read some of your research, that may not be the best way to look at it. Why is that?
We're coming off of a pretty brutal 2023, to be honest, for many of us who have been in the life sciences for years. I think it's widely recognized that 2023 was perhaps one of the most challenging years in memory, in the real estate industry at least. The combination of a slowdown in the deployment of venture capital, higher interest rates, higher inflation, the effects, if you will, of a post-COVID hangover, and the effects of rather aggressive real estate development for lab space in the past 2 years created conditions that were pretty unfavorable in 2023. We're all anticipating, hoping, expecting that 2024 will be better. And I think it's fair to say, just on the early activity we've seen in the past 3 weeks, that the year is already shaping up to be much more positive than the year before. So fingers crossed, Sarah, that we are looking at a return to an upwards trajectory in the months and year to come.
Great. And it sounds like you have to look at individual markets rather than making that broad brush statement.
Absolutely. If there's one thing that 2023 taught us, is that everything is hyperlocal. And by that, not only is it important to look at the individual markets and the characteristics of the individual markets, it's also important to look at the neighborhoods or the microclimates within those markets, because there is no monolithic performance that we can ascribe to even a market overall anymore. You take the Boston market, for example, and while one can make assumptions based on the overall metrics as it relates to development and vacancy and so on and so forth, once you dive into particular neighborhoods, Kendall Square as opposed to Waltham, or the South Boston waterfront opposed to Watertown, you'll see that even within these microclimates, the performance is radically different. And I could replay that for Boston, San Diego, San Francisco, any of the mature markets. The overall picture is very, very local.
Travis, your research also observes that it's an occupier's market. How so, and how does this compare to what you've seen in previous years?
Yeah, in previous years, there was always a pretty tight correlation between demand for space and the market's response with the development of space. So there was always a fairly tight bandwidth, while there's always some degree of asymmetry and always some degree of market disequilibrium. In the real estate industry, tended to respond fairly slowly to that asymmetry or that disequilibrium. In 2022 and 2023, post-COVID, there was a bull run, a rush to develop lab space. Many new market entrants were attracted to the life sciences market, and we overreacted. In some markets, we overreacted more than others. And as a result, when you take a look at this bandwidth, there is a historic high availability of lab space across the United States compared to demand. We've never seen this degree of disequilibrium before. And we're just now starting to come down off of the peak of that, where we're about 3x or 4x, depending on the market, with too much space. To be crass, we're a python swallowing a pig. And it's simply going to take us a little time to digest this amount of lab space with the rates of entrepreneurship and the rates of demand that we're seeing in all of our markets. Again, I'm painting the United States with a broad brush. Some markets, there's a less disequilibrium than in others. But generally speaking, we have way too much real estate compared to demand. The market in particular that is the most out of whack, so to speak, is Boston. 60% of all lab space under development in the United States of America is in the greater Boston market.
That's quite a number for that market.
It is.
And Travis, are you seeing construction methods for the life science industry changing at all? And does that in any way impact pricing?
Construction methodology always is evolving. Our engineers are constantly coming up with new ways to build and design these facilities. So it's construction methodologies is constantly evolving, generally speaking. For the life sciences, I would say that we're seeing the most rapid evolution outside of the United States, frankly, in Western Europe in particular, where construction methodology is incorporating sustainability principles much more quickly than we're seeing here in the United States. And that is affecting pricing a bit on the front end, but it's also positively affecting the design of these facilities and the operation of these facilities over the long term. In the United States, the driver of cost for these facilities is not really construction methodology. It's just the price of debt. It's the price of debt and supply chain still being a bit backed up for some of our specialized equipment that these facilities need.
Great. And Travis, you've also written about the impact of AI on life science. Is AI a win-win for the biopharma industry and commercial real estate, or is it a bit more complex than that?
We could talk for hours about the way in which artificial intelligence is disrupting the life sciences, but let me categorize. When we say artificial intelligence and its effect on the life sciences, let me just, with a broad brush, categorize what we mean. There are basically four ways to think about it. One is the degree to which artificial intelligence is driving new discoveries. A classic example, perfect example of that would be AlphaFold and our ability to discover novel proteins that we never would have been able to discover without the use of machine learning. These are just brand new discoveries. The second category would be the degree to which old tech is becoming new again. And by that, in particular, the resurgence of the small molecule drug market. With the help of artificial intelligence, we have improved target identification and improved compound screening. We have greater efficiency and accelerated time with our early stage research. And there's a degree to which we have our ability to go back through this massive drug library that we have and find candidates and even tweak these candidates with novel chemical structures for existing targets or even new targets that we're able to identify with artificial intelligence. It's this old tech, small molecule drugs that we all thought 5 years ago was inexorably going to be replaced by biologics and cell and gene therapy. And that is simply not the case. The third category, and I think this is the one where we have the least amount of visibility into where the future is heading for commercial real estate, and that's the degree to which artificial intelligence is making possible new tools physically manifest in the lab. I think a great example of that are SDLs or self-driving laboratories that are able to make fully autonomous protein engineering. These types of new physical environments, new types and new opportunities for automation are forcing us in the commercial real estate industry to rethink not only how you design these labs, but also where does an SDL need to be relative to people? So the location analytics effects that are being forced by artificial intelligence. And then lastly, it's frankly, their new cost structures. The licensing arrangements that are now necessary to make these tools available to your scientists and the increased costs associated with computing power. It's no coincidence, or no mistake, I should say, it's a great coincidence that there's a significant overlap between the top markets for data centers based on power utilization and power consumption with our top markets for the life sciences. Just these are new costs into the system. So it is absolutely impossible at this stage to say one way or the other in a binary kind of a way, it is good or bad for the life sciences. I think from a real estate perspective, the effects are still being felt. But one thing is, I think, pretty clear. Our scientists are able to do more with less. Every researcher is increasingly becoming a full-stack investigator with tools that allow her to do more in a shorter period of time. As these tools become more ubiquitous across the entirety of the scientific process, that means that eventually there is going to be an improved efficiency and efficacy of our work. And eventually, it will also improve both the rate and de-risking of startups. So while on the one hand, you're doing more with less, on the other hand, we should expect to see an uptick in the number of life sciences startups that are out there. So it's very much early how all of this is going to shake out and affect the commercial real estate industry. But I think it's fair to say that there is disruption to come.
We'll have to follow up on that one, I'm sure. Yeah.
And apologies for going on about it, but this is real time. And I think we would be very wise to expect further disruption from an infrastructure standpoint.
So, Travis, is AI really the main story, or are there other key breakthroughs or developments that you anticipate providing both opportunity and challenges for the life science real estate sector?
Yeah, there are a couple of really cool things that are happening as affect us in the real estate industry. One area that we've talked about before is manufacturing. From a physical environment standpoint, we don't have enough manufacturing capacity globally in order to be able to meet our scientific ambition, both from a pharmaceutical standpoint as well as from a bioindustrial standpoint. On the pharmaceutical side, I think it was the Financial Times that named GLP-1 agonists as the technology of the year. We don't have enough manufacturing capacity globally to manufacture these GLP-1 agonists. And that this is sort of behind the investments that are being made by Novo Nordisk and Eli Lilly and all the other companies that have these products. On the flip side, you see these really radical bioindustrial manufacturing needs. I'll point to one in Brazil. We have launching this year in 2024 a massive factory that will manufacture about 5 billion genetically modified mosquitoes a year. And these mosquitoes will help us tackle, from a public health standpoint, mosquitoes' ability to infect with dengue, Zika, and the like. And that's just one example of a bioindustrial use. So we need, as an industry, to help figure out this manufacturing conundrum, this advanced manufacturing conundrum, not only just the physical footprint of it, but the financing of these types of facilities. The second cool opportunity, depending on how you think about cool, but we have to think differently about how we design our facilities and where we put our facilities as it relates to climate change. We can no longer stick our heads in the sand about it. It's not just about where we put our facilities. We have to think about the effects of flooding on decisions to put, for example, our cogen plants in the basement. We have to think in terms of the Pfizer disaster in North Carolina put a lot of people on notice, having a facility destroyed by a tornado like that. I think it's incumbent upon us to think in terms of how we design, the power that we choose to deploy, the decisions that we make architecturally. From the real estate standpoint, we should be prosecuting everything as it relates to the building envelope in order to deliver a better product for our scientists. And that relates to a challenge. I mentioned before, there were quite a few new market entrants that brought online life sciences assets over the past few years. And regretfully, we have to acknowledge the fact that not everyone that brought online life sciences assets brought good assets to the market. And we are starting to see, you know, tip of the iceberg, we're starting to see the effect of that with assets that are only 1 to 3 years old, and they're already seeing their age. It raises a lot of questions. You try and remediate these poor assets? Do you let them lay fallow and divert them to other use? In some cases, these are proverbial white elephants that were very expensive to build, but they just were built inadequately. And we have to now, as an industry, deal with the downstream effect of that. So lots to do in 2024.
Yeah, there's a lot to cover.
Indeed.
Travis, we've covered so many interesting things. Anything you think our listeners might need to know before I let you finish up?
The only thing I would throw out there is pretty much everything we've talked about so far has been in relation to the biopharma industry. And one area we always keep a parallel eye on, particularly as it relates to artificial intelligence and facilities, is the medical device industry and the med tech industry. We could have an entire conversation just about that industry because it's behaving a little bit different than biopharma, both in terms of facilities, the market, how AI is disrupting the physical environment. But I'd certainly challenge our listeners to keep a parallel eye on med tech in 2024.
Excellent, Travis. Thank you so much for your time.
Anytime. This was great, Sarah. Thanks for inviting me back.
To our listeners, if you enjoyed this episode of the REIT Report, please subscribe or leave a review on your favorite podcast platform.